This episode is sponsored by Charlie HR, the HR software your team will actually love. Both Rich and I use it for our businesses, and they can do everything from tracking time off, making it easy for employees to request and managers to approve, automatically keeping track of time off allowances so no more annoying spreadsheets, which everyone hates, and it even integrates into your company calendar and Slack for visibility of who's away and when.
Yeah, it's especially great for onboarding new members of your team because it collects all the personal information you need. It also gives you this great team directory, allowing everyone to see a list of employees. We've also been using it recently for performance reviews and training, as well as key dates, birthdays, and appraisals. It's just great that everything is finally in one place.
The main point is building a business is bloody hard and running one shouldn't be. So if you're looking to improve your HR processes and just make the whole experience of running a company that little bit easier, check out the beautifully designed charliehr.com. It's completely free to get up and running, so go do it today.
Right, so episode 2, and recorded in a slightly more echoey room this time round. I guess the benefit of being in a co-working space doing this is you find a different room every time and you make do, proper startup style. And Rich and I have actually just been talking about how much we hate the sound of our own voice, which is obviously an incredibly ironic and disappointing fact when you are publishing a podcast.
Yeah, well, you do have a particularly croaky voice. Anyway, so we've got an interesting guest today.
We do. She's not even 30, I don't think. It's kind of sickening.
And she's got an MBE, which is brilliant.
I feel like a lot more of our guests as we go along this journey have an MBE or a CBE.
Yeah, the titles get grander and grander.
Yeah, and of course they culminate with a royal prince.
Exactly. So, Alice Bentinck, fabulous entrepreneur in herself, setting up Entrepreneur First. We go into the highs and lows of her journey, starting one of the UK's top incubators, and you know, working with some brilliant companies.
Yep, she's awesome. She's a lovely woman. I think less from us and more from her. So taking you into today's episode.
From Runway East Studios in London, welcome to the Secret Lives of Leaders.
Today's guest is one of the UK's most impressive women in tech and all things entrepreneurship. She started her professional career as an intern to Tony Blair, but there's no evidence to date that she influenced the war in Iraq, so don't worry. Is that fair to say?
No comment.
Okay, so following a stint at McKinsey, she started a meta-entrepreneur journey with Entrepreneur First, which is based around the very concept of helping others through the journey of entrepreneurship with a tech focus. Fondly known as EF to its friends, but no longer officially due to a similarly popular institution with the same initials in the US, they've already helped over 350 individuals build 100 companies with a total valuation of $500 million. As if this isn't enough, she's also the co-founder of the Code First Girls free web programming courses for women in university. An advocate for the entry of more women to the tech field, she was named one of the 50 most inspiring women in European tech by the Inspiring 50 organization in 2015, and has just been awarded an MBE by the Royal Family for services to business. She also just closed a new fund of over £40 million to help graduates build companies, so 2016 has been a busy but amazing year for her. They say never ask a lady her age, so instead I'll just tell you that she's accomplished all this by the age of 30 and doesn't look a day over 29. Welcome to today's inspiring guest, Alice Bentinck. So hello to you, Alice.
Thank you. Hello. Thank you for having me.
A pleasure. So first things first, and to get you in the mood and to throw you off topic, obviously, so you're immediately uncomfortable, please answer these quickfire questions. Cats or dogs?
Dogs.
Wrong.
Sorry.
Donald Trump or Vladimir Putin?
Neither. How can you even answer that?
Just do it.
Neither. No, I won't.
Accenture or McKinsey?
McKinsey.
Liar. Tony Blair or Theresa May?
Tony Blair.
Yeah, that's fair. I'd probably go with him as well. Gin or vodka?
Gin.
Favourite musician?
Oh, very nice.
Theresa May?
Theresa May. listening to Son? Son? I don't know how you say it. S-O-H-N at the moment. But
oh, interesting. Okay, edgy. CEO of a 10-person company or COO of a 100-person company?
It's all about scale. 100-person.
Okay. London or elsewhere?
Depends what for, but London you get most things.
Okay. Most impressive founder you've ever met?
I think Siraj Khalik, who founded Climate Corp, and sold it for $1 billion is really impressive. He was one of the first 20 engineers at Google and left, and everyone thought he was crazy, and then went on to build his own $1 billion company, which I think is pretty cool.
Yeah, that is very cool. And person you aspire to?
Having recently read her autobiography, Emmeline Pankhurst, the founder of the Suffragettes, or the leader of the Suffragettes,
wow.
She is unbelievable.
Yeah.
Like, she got completely roughed up by gangs of men repeatedly while she was kind of fighting for her cause. And she did something that was completely unexpected of her at that time. And if I could even be 10% of what she's like, that would be awesome.
Before you started Entrepreneur First, you worked in Tony Blair's office. Was that helpful for you with regards to where your journey has taken you?
I think the really interesting thing was it was just after he had stopped being Prime Minister. And I think understanding what a world-class leader looks like, somebody who's been a leader on a world stage, I think in terms of now leading a very small company, there's lots that I was able to learn from that and kind of see from being that close to it, which was pretty cool.
Next up, McKinsey. I can't wait for your non-political answers here. So what did you do there? Would you recommend it to people? Do you love it? Do you hate it? Or are you just too scared of the consequences to give an opinion on the record?
I met Matt, my co-founder at McKinsey, which was definitely one of the amazing parts of McKinsey. And I think the people in general, being surrounded by super smart, super ambitious people that were willing to work hard and get stuff done, that was a great way to start my career. Did lots of work with companies and so this is sort of 2009-ish, who were thinking about tech and thinking about technology. And back then it was like, oh, e-commerce, should we do e-commerce? Do you think that's going to be a thing? Which seemed very, you know, it's 2009, that should have been obvious. But I suppose it was a useful lesson in terms of how big companies think about technology and how long it takes them to think about adoption. Mm. It was a useful experience.
Okay. That is a as detailed an answer as I imagine we're going to get out of you for that. So you neither loved it nor hated it.
I think being surrounded by lots of super ambitious and smart people, if you can make that true for the entirety of your career, you're winning. And I suppose that was part of the inspiration for EF, of how can we create a group and community of people who are all dedicated to doing something, you know, crazy ambitious with their lives. It was a useful couple of years.
So is that what basically sparked the idea for Entrepreneur First? Was it like, what exactly gives someone who's never started a company before the idea to start a company that helps people start companies? It's quite meta. So did you just watch Inception a few times and come up with the idea?
It's quite meta. So we started in 2011, which was when Tech City was just becoming a thing and Silicon Roundabout was just becoming a thing. So people were beginning to talk about startups. And I suppose part of the McKinsey experience was going through university and being presented with four career options from which you could choose. And it was broadly, you know, law, banking, consulting, accounting. And Matt, my co-founder, had done a year at MIT and had seen the kind of excitement around startups. And it wasn't people who were necessarily really experienced going to start startups. It was, you know, young technologists who were just crazy ambitious and wanted to try their hand at building something. So the combination of those two things, thinking about actually why do we have such limited career options in the UK, and how can we help people get excited about building a startup and founding a startup. But when we started, we were a not-for-profit. We were a not-for-profit community interest company. Tried to incorporate as a charity, but they wouldn't let us due to various reasons.
Did you find that even more complicated than just running a for-profit?
I wouldn't necessarily recommend the community interest company structure. It's quite restrictive. But it was also partly because we wanted to do this kind of education piece around becoming an entrepreneur, but there was never any belief that that would actually lead to startups. We thought maybe that would happen, but I think in the ecosystem, from the people that we were speaking to at the time, the people we were trying to get advice from, it seemed like it probably wasn't going to work.
Mm. And you met Matt at McKinsey. Mm. So how long were you working with him before you hatched this idea together?
We never worked together. So McKinsey takes in a bunch of graduates every year and you join in a batch. And we were in the same batch and kind of bonded in our training week. And we'd have lunch together every week and just have really interesting conversations and chats about what we'd want to do with our lives. And eventually decided that actually we should try and build something together, and came up with a variety of really bad ideas. And then decided that we didn't know what we were doing. We should go and get proper jobs. And I went and got a job at Google, and Matt was sort of still unclear about what he wanted to do and started the very initial idea for Entrepreneur First. And after doing that for a month, he was like, literally the day that I was signing my contract for Google, he was like, don't do that, come and do this with me. And I just knew in my gut that I would always regret it. Whatever happened, I'd always regret it if I didn't. So I did. And it was one of those things where literally everyone was just like, but think of the free food. How can you do this? Think of the free food. Think of the benefits.
It's good free food.
But it was definitely the right choice.
How was it funded to begin with?
So for about 2 years, it was a running joke of, you know, wouldn't it be great if we had a business model? And we just sold corporate sponsorship. We sold anything we could to try and get corporates to give us cash. So we'd be like, you can recruit everyone, or, you know, we'll give you tons of PR. Our brand is really strong in the startup world. You know, it's just all, we were grabbing at straws. But we did manage to get together enough cash to do the first 6 months. And then we were selling this program where people were going to have to be with us for another 6 months. We had no way of paying for it. So it really was a kind of hand to mouth of just trying to get any corporate cash in. But I wouldn't recommend that. Having a business model that doesn't scale with what you do doesn't really work.
Did you have some serious barriers to break down people to get to trust you with your vision? Mm. Like, you know, how did that all come about? Because again, you didn't have any track record.
Yeah.
And so taking people's cash to give to other people who don't have any track record to run their own shit, it's just a very risky model. And I mean, you've obviously proven yourself now, but how, like, take us through those early days, like how you actually convinced people.
Yeah, well, I mean, so the really weird thing that we were doing was working with people pre-team and pre-ideas. So we're just taking individuals and saying that magically somehow we would put them into teams with ideas. And we didn't realize how hard that was going to be. And it was really, really hard. And it took us about 3 years to work out how to do that in a reasonably reliable way. But we didn't invest for the first year. The first group of people that came and did the program, we didn't give them any money at all. We had no money to give them. So we just gave them slightly ropey support. And it wasn't until year three that we were properly able to start investing, and we didn't raise a fund until year four. So it took a while to kind of build up the credibility and to prove that the model worked. I mean, the first 6 months were that sort of depressing early stage founder thing where everyone you meet who's more experienced, more grown up than you, has more years and money than you will ever have, was just like, "Ooh, interesting idea, but, you know, don't do that. How about running a jobs fair or something that, you know, will definitely work." Mm-hmm. And it was only because we were going to, and it was just university students at that stage, we were going to universities and students were desperate for this. There's so much low hanging fruit, just so much latent demand. And that was the piece that kept us going.
What universities did you recruit from originally?
We went everywhere. So okay. For about 6 months, I lived on British Rail, which wasn't pleasant. So Edinburgh, Imperial, Surrey, Canterbury, Manchester, Exeter, I mean, you name it, we went there.
And you mentioned first couple of years, you didn't have any funds to offer us, only in your third year that you were able to invest. So do you see any notable difference between those cohorts? I mean, you know, and what is, like all startups, I'm sure the obvious answer is year one cohorts, not quite as well supported as year three. But do you see any correlation in that, or are there some outliers?
So we were able to, we had a sort of angel group connected to us in the second year. So we were able to give, invest cash, although we weren't doing the investing in the second year. I mean, it being able to, one of the unusual things we do is we give individuals money pre-team and pre-idea. And that definitely opened the doors. So, having 3 months funded to think about starting a startup and work out what idea you should work on and what team you should work in, that definitely changed the game. So people suddenly felt that they could take the risk, and that they could pay to live in London and all those other kind of like life admin things. So that did make a difference.
Are you also putting teams together or people together as you're doing it? So you're a bit like the Simon Cowell of the
world. I guess in your own words, why don't you describe Entrepreneur First for us and our listeners?
So Entrepreneur First helps the world's most ambitious technologists build startups from scratch. So we take 100 individuals every 6 months. They usually have computer science, engineering backgrounds, and we take them through a process of building their team, developing their idea, finding their customers, going through the investment process, scaling. And we've just, at the second fund that we've just raised, means that we now work with companies from the point where they're individuals with nothing all the way through to Series A. So we can now provide a lot more support and funding along the way as well. But yeah, so we see ourselves as a company builder, basically. So we build teams from scratch, we develop ideas from scratch, and we spent the last 5 years learning how to do that most effectively.
And how much time do you get to personally spend on the ideas? Do you influence ideas? Do you get to see every single idea that comes out? You know, how much time do you actually get to play? That's because that sounds like the fun part.
It's the fun part.
Yeah.
So as the company's been growing, I spend less time directly with the companies, but still have a bird's eye view of everything that's going on. In terms of ideas, we do a lot of influencing. I think one of the hard things is to know what a good idea looks like when you aren't part of the startup scene and you haven't seen a ton of ideas and all the rest of it. So a lot of what we do is help people find the right idea for them. So everyone has to have an edge. So everyone has to have something that they either know about, not necessarily a problem, but they know about an industry, or they have a piece of technology that they can build, and then they need to use that to develop an idea.
What have been your three greatest successes whilst running Entrepreneur First, and what are your three favourite company ideas?
So in terms of successes, the most visible one that we've had to date is Magic Pony Technology, which was a company that was 18 months old that we sold to Twitter for a reported $150 million earlier this year. And that was a company that was building visual processing technology, so anything around video compression and things like that.
Love it. I love how it's like Pied Piper from Silicon Valley.
Yeah, exactly. It's incredible, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. And that was a great company that had grown very, very quickly and was building, working on just some incredible technology, very valuable technology.
How many employees did they have when they sold?
15. I think the CEO was the only one that didn't have a PhD.
Wow. How much did they raise to that point?
It's undisclosed.
Until now.
Until now.
When rich.
But you have
guesses.
To wait. Have to wait until the end of the podcast to hear.
Worth a try, right?
Yeah.
So I think, you know, that's our most visible success, and for us, it was a great validation of the model. So you can take two people who've never met each other before, who have come in with no clear idea of what they want to work on, and you can help them build a valuable company in a reasonably short amount of time. I suppose in terms of like EF company successes. This year has been a really big year for us, so raising a £40 million fund. I think 5 years ago, we would never have believed that people would allow us to manage that much money. And using that as well to grow the team. So we went from, this time last year, we were 8 people, we're now 40 people in 2 countries. So
in Singapore as well, right?
Yeah, we just opened an office in Singapore, which is going really well. And I'm very proud of the team that we have around us. We have some amazing people, some of whom have been with us almost since the beginning, others of whom have joined us recently, but have completely thrown themselves into what we believe and the culture and all the rest of it. So I think that's definitely one of our successes. And the third piece, I mean, I think, so you could compare EF to Teach First, I think, in one way, and that's kind of changing the way that people see their career options.
And the first, yes. So two ways.
But the most important way is, you know, Teach First changed the way that people saw teaching as a career. It made it much sexier. You saw more and more people aspiring to be teachers. And what we're seeing is more and more people are aspiring, see entrepreneurship as an aspirational career path. And one stat which I love is that at one top university, more people now join EF than the entirety of the financial services sector. I just think that's really cool.
That is amazing. Very cool. Out of the 40 people you've got, how many, and what are the kind of jobs that are people doing? Do you have like shared resource within that your companies can kind of use, or are these primarily people just kind of sifting through applications and stuff?
We have a team that finds the people. So we speak to about 3,000 people every year, and we whittle that down to the 200 we end up working with. We have a team that works directly with the companies. So we have 6 partners who are all exited entrepreneurs who work directly with the companies on a day-to-day basis. We have a tech team in-house. We have a ops team. We have to do tons of work on visas, unfortunately, because we have a very international talent base. So everyone's kept pretty busy. But we're, yeah, we're in some ways we are like a fund in that we deploy capital, and in other ways we're much more like a company in that we have a, you know, kind of we produce a product and yeah. we have a operating team.
This next section is all about you, so we're just going to try and work out how interesting you really are.
Oh God.
Yes. So question number one, have you ever been arrested?
No, or even not yet.
Not yet. Better. Better, absolutely. Tell us something unusual about you that not many people know.
When I was growing up, I was obsessed with goats, and I had 9.
Goats are like second to cats on the internet. Very popular.
I'm
obsessed with cats. I know, I feel the same way. I swear I was really into cats before anyone else was into it. Now I met a goat fan.
Yeah.
You had nine goats.
Yeah, I started off with 2 and then the obsession grew, as did the tiny herd. But they're just like, they're like dogs, but better. They're so loyal. They're really amusing. They're very loving.
Did they grow into big ones?
We had a little ones and big ones, so pygmy and British Saanen, if you know your great goat breeds.
Alice, how do you see yourself? Who is the glorious Alice Bentinck? And describe yourself how you think other people see you.
Well, I suppose I think one of the hard things about being a founder or entrepreneur or whatever is where do you stop and the company start, and how much do those two things merge? Because you just do spend so much of your life with the company and in the company and around the company. But having said that, I don't know, that's a really hard one. I see myself as, I suppose I really relate to myself when I'm on the sofa watching Netflix, binging on Penny Sweets. But I would hope that isn't how most people see me.
Yeah, I think you've probably got a better public persona than that. You know, the idea that actually you're a layabout isn't probably how most people see you. Well, Rich,
there's a trend going on here, because Alithia said that she just sits at home watching, not all the time, obviously, she runs a successful business.
She watches trashy TV, doesn't she?
Quite a lot of like series. She was very knowledgeable on the Netflix catalogue.
But there's something about trashy TV that when you're at work, and because you are working so much, you have to be so switched on all the time that the light relief of total trash is it's just like, it's like penny sweets for the brain. It's amazing.
Interesting. So you know, any other deep insights into how you wish people saw you?
I wish people saw me. Well, this should be aspirational, right?
Sure.
As the next leader of the AI revolution that will control the AI machine that will eventually run the world.
Interesting.
I don't know if I'm quite there yet, though.
No.
Yeah.
What with the fact that you don't actually have a company that's even slightly investigating AI personally, and therefore I'm assuming don't actually work a day in AI.
I think we're the biggest investor in AI companies than anyone else in Europe.
Really?
Yeah.
That doesn't make you specifically the person in control of it all, though.
I see.
Okay. There's all these takeovers. There's basically, what she's trying to say is, if you are joining Entrepreneur First, then check the legals, because at some point she will be in control of all of the AI you're developing.
Whilst we're talking about AI, and it's quite a deep question, but I was talking to somebody about it the other day. What do you think will be the future of mankind in terms of like the general person's job prospects and things like that? If you look at, you know, how certain jobs are going out, don't exist anymore, like checkout in checkout tills, it's all machines. In Tesla's factory, it's all machines. In a lot of car factories, it's all machines. With AI, that accelerates job losses in certain areas a lot more. Is that self-destructive?
Well, I think you've got to look at it as AI is coming and it's going to happen, and governments can't control it and aren't and probably shouldn't be trying to control it. They're probably the wrong institutions to try and control it. So then how can we make whatever change AI brings to the workforce a positive one, not a negative one? I don't know what the answer is on that, but I think it's something we probably need to think more about as a country. But it's very hard when you don't know. Is it 10 years, is it 15 years, or is it 50 years? And when you have governments that are in power for only 4 or 5 years at a time, I think it's very hard, and they're not technically minded. I think it's very hard for them to plan in that way. And I think it will cause lots of social upheaval, but we need to try and work out how that can be a positive thing rather than a kind of human destroying thing.
Because I guess governments have this conflict that they want, you know, AI is all about efficiency and using machines to their, you know, full potential, yet a lot of populations survive from the inefficiencies of certain things. Like, you know, people are in jobs because they are carrying out tasks that can't be carried out by computers and are inefficient things. And I think that governments have a tricky job to essentially manage that, won't they?
Yeah, I think they've got a big job on their hands in terms of working out what's next.
I think the argument, the long-term argument, is actually you're just trying to retrain a population into tech and, you know, deeper sciences where they can contribute to other AI-based resources rather than farming, rather than some of the more manual things. And that's kind of the longer-term concept. But at the same time, you know, you've got, like you say, you don't know the time frame on it, and you've got Moore's Law fighting against you. So coming back to the topic of Alice Bentinck, do you feel successful?
I think the moment you feel successful, you've probably lost it. As in, it's building a startup is a constant battle against not dying. And the moment that you kind of get to a steady state, you have to make that choice about whether you want to break it to make something bigger. So I think believing you're successful is the kind of thing you can do at the end of your life and look back. But I think there's just so, I think it's something you continuously work at.
But wouldn't you say that Mark Zuckerberg feels successful and Facebook is probably not going anywhere?
Well, I think it'd be really interesting to ask him that. Does he perceive himself as successful, or is this just the start of something bigger that he wants to do? And yes, he's already done a lot, but maybe his ambition is larger than what he's already created. I mean, yeah, I don't know.
I guess there's a common theme to never really be satisfied with where you are and just consistently be moving because you're always future planning.
Okay, so you mentor startups all over the country. So who mentors you?
I mean, Matt and I are very lucky that we've got an amazing group of people around us. I think one of the things I would say about mentorship is thinking about what's it for? And I think it's sometimes really hard to have one mentor that can do everything. And a recent investment that's been absolutely amazing is having a professional coach. And we've now got an unbelievable professional coach we've worked with her for a year now. And I think she can take credit for a lot of the positive changes over the last year to the business and to me as a human.
And do you share her with some of your teams then? Like, how does that work?
So Matt and I use the same coach, and that works really well because we do a session separately and a session together. And we've started using... the problem with coaches is that they're not very scalable.
Yes.
So we now use a variety of coaches with our teams. And broadly, I think it's one of those things that... Maybe it's like therapy. I haven't had therapy, but it's one of those things that people don't really talk about. But it's so valuable. So I would encourage everyone to get a professional coach, regardless of whether you're a founder or not.
Fair enough. Who is the most inspiring person you've ever met and why?
To be really cheesy, the cohort that we get to work with. I mean, the reason why this job is fun is because every 6 months we work with 100 people who are building stuff that the people two cohorts ago couldn't build just because the technology hadn't even been... It wasn't possible at that stage. Things are changing so, so quickly that... I'm always kept on my toes, as in there is the amount of learning that we have to do around the space that we're working in is you have to update it constantly. And so seeing all these amazing people taking the risk to do something like EF, quitting amazing jobs and then building ideas that hopefully will be not only the next billion-dollar company, but also make a substantial change to the way that humans live, I think that's pretty inspiring.
So what do you actually get up to when you aren't busy running EF? Do you get time for other interests, or is it just couch potato or super hard work?
In an ideal world, I would fill my flat with goats, but it's probably not. I don't know what the RSPCA would say about that. Very London, like eating, drinking, friends, cycling.
So city life, yeah.
City life. I was brought up in the New Forest, so I'm a big fan of going back there for... my boyfriend always says that I act like I'm 15 when I'm at home, which I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it's that kind of...
We don't
of,
know what you were like at 15, but that doesn't sound like a good
imagine
thing.
Imagine lots of goats.
Crazy goat.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the hard things as a founder is it's hard to have... I find it hard to have multiple different interests and competing, as in like life maintenance while running a company can be hard. So I invest heavily in friends and friendships and making sure I spend lots of time with the people that I've known for decades. And I find that probably the most revitalizing and invigorating thing.
You touched on this earlier. You said, you know, you haven't done therapy, for example, but you imagine it's very good, very healthy, and you have coaching for yourself, for your team. And, you know, you speak a lot to your friends, and actually that kind of normality is very healthy for you. But it's a lot of discussion in the ecosystem, and there's a lot of zeitgeist around mental strength, around resilience. What's your actual take on founder mental health? Do you have any specific sections or teachings at EF around that with your teams?
Yeah, I mean, I think the mental burden of being a founder is, yeah, it's hard, and it probably isn't talked about as much as it could be. One of the books that completely changed the way that I think about this is Mindset by Carol Dweck. And my team always take the piss because I'm completely obsessed by it. And growth mindset is something that's now taught in schools everywhere. If you go into a school of 16-year-olds and ask them about growth mindset, they all know about it. But our generation hasn't necessarily come across it. And it's broadly this idea that everything you do is a learning experience. And that different people approach that in different ways. So some people see failure as, I am a failure because I failed. I, as a person, I'm a failure. And they take that to heart, and it affects how they see, it affects their self-esteem. Whereas if you have a growth mindset, every failure, every kind of knock you see as a learning experience, and use that to get better. And so this idea, I think, for founders, when, you know, when you're reading something like, you're like, shit, this is exactly what we need. So we now select people based on their growth mindset. It's one of the things that we look for, and it's helping people think about every failure and knock as a founder is actually a learning experience. Like, you can take something positive away from it, and it just means that all the knocks aren't knocks, they're actually just steps. So it's something that when I think about how to remain resilient and all the rest of it, I think growth mindset has really helped. And it's something that we're trying to do more and more of generally around EF.
Okay, so it's more about like an entire thesis rather than specific practices that you like put upon people, so to speak, you know? So it's not like sort of cultural attitude towards, right, Friday 4 p.m. We're doing meditation. There's nothing like that sort of set in stone there.
No, we don't. We have, you know, people run yoga in the office and other bits and pieces, but I think the mindset stuff has been the biggest change that we've made.
Okay, and what do you personally do to stay in shape and keep an active, healthy mind? So yoga, working out, meditation, all the normal things. Give us some health hacks.
So I'm very hyperactive and very lazy at the same time. So I want to be able to exercise but not put any effort into it. So cycle everywhere all the time. And then the other thing is pop sugar videos. They're 10 minutes. So get up, run out of bed, put on 10 minutes of YouTube, pop sugar, and they do these kind of crazy intense workouts that you do.
Pop Sugar is in the media company, Pop Sugar.
Yeah, Pop Sugar Fitness. And they have these super peppy, like, American women who you wake up and you're, like, half asleep and you've barely been awake for kind of 3 minutes, and then you're, you know, doing burpees or whatever. And they're just like, you can't help but get into it.
Yeah.
And it's sharp, painful, and then you're done.
Are you religious? Are you spiritual?
I'm not religious. I'm not sure what spiritual means, so it probably means I'm not.
Or do you believe in a higher power, or are you too scientific for that?
I think probably too scientific.
Just believe in AI. So you just believe in the paperclip theory, and essentially we're all fucked, but...
So you might have heard of Elon Musk's theory, or yeah, I don't know where he got it from, that he thinks we're in a simulation. And do you think that that's what we are? We're in a simulation, and there's essentially we're in the Matrix?
I don't think we are in a simulation, but if we are, it's not that bad.
Because I guess you could say that if we are, the same argument as he had, that mankind has survived to put us in a simulation. So, that's, you know, the Earth hasn't blown up.
Thank God.
Or, well, yeah, I guess it just about hasn't, right? Just God knows what it looks like outside of these walls. And these are pretty depressing walls to be recording in as well, to be fair. Yeah. So he's not done a great job with this Matrix simulation, I've got to be honest. Okay, people say entrepreneurs are crazy and you know more than most. So are they crazy, and do you think you're crazy?
We look for megalomania. I think there is, or personal exceptionism, this kind of... the world could literally explode, implode, whatever, but you would be okay. That people who have that belief, and maybe that's crazy, or maybe that's just what it takes to get through. So I think it's very fashionable to be crazy, and it's very fashionable for founders to have a big kind of extreme personality. And I think founders are often at extremes. But I think the common theme of crazy, and maybe it's crazy or maybe it's not, is this kind of personal exceptionalism, this belief that you'll be okay, even if everything else fails, even if the world ends, you'll be okay.
Mm. Fair. Okay, so last section is on regrets and mistakes. So starting negatively, as we always would, any regrets?
I think with the growth mindset mantra, you're meant to have regrets. I don't think I do have any regrets. I think regrets, I think they can be quite pernicious and make life much harder if you hold on to them. So I'd say lots of failures and mistakes, but no regrets.
Okay, fine. What is your biggest personality flaw then? So can you give our listeners some insight into how to be less like you?
So I think one of the hard things about being a founder and being part of a company that grows very quickly is wanting to be in everything. And actually, it's really fun to be in everything. And there are some really small decisions that are quite fun to make. But actually, for your team, it's just really annoying for you to be constantly being like, oh, I've got an idea. So I think, don't. And it's not even micromanagement necessarily. It's more just like, oh, let me be involved. And I think particularly as the company grows, being able to step back and focus on the bigger picture. So I'd probably say that.
Okay, fair enough. So you look quite serious in a lot of your photos, but you've always seemed pretty chilled to me, and maybe that's just because you've never had to manage me. But do you actually get pissed off? What pisses you off?
On the photo thing, it's so... Why do people want to take grumpy pictures? People always are like, no smiling. Isn't that weird?
Yeah, that's true.
It really pisses me off when people drive too close when you're cycling on purpose. I think that is unfair and stupid. And cyclists can be dicks. We can all be dicks sometimes. But I think trying to make a point by endangering someone's life is pretty annoying.
Yep, I think that's very fair.
I totally agree.
So cyclist perspective, is a pedestrian less annoying than a car driver?
I sometimes find pedestrians more scary, and I know I probably do this as a pedestrian as well, is the randomly walking out into traffic thing, because you aren't necessarily expecting it.
What's the number one thing you see young entrepreneurs doing that winds you up more than most?
Everyone comes up with the same ideas, unfortunately. And it's definitely not their fault. But I think one of the reasons EF exists is to help people realise what a good idea looks like and to come up with something that could potentially be a really big company.
But isn't it all about execution? So does it really matter that everyone comes up with the same idea?
Well, you want to give yourself the best chance of building a big company, right? And you also want to think about what skills you have that mean you would be the best founder. And I think the problem that we often see is that people want to start companies that have no connection with any of their skills or knowledge or any of their background. And I think that's often the missing piece. So it's just saying to people, okay, cool. Well, why are you the best person to start this company? What do you know about it? What are the skills that you have? What's the competitive advantage you have?
So don't hold back on this question, but what's the worst business concept you've ever been pitched for EF?
We get the same ideas over and over again. So anything around dating, probably I've heard every dating idea that's ever existed. And probably food delivery as well. We get every variation you can imagine on food delivery we have seen. But it's often from people who have a PhD in artificial intelligence, and they just don't see the connection between what they could build and what they should build. And there's tons of people who should build amazing food delivery startups, but it's probably not somebody who has a PhD in AI. We're in a weird position that we do see lots of ideas, but they're very unformed in that they're not actually startups.
Okay, fair enough. What's the best piece of advice you've ever been given?
Strong beliefs weakly held.
Strong belief.
Strong beliefs weekly held.
Oh, nice.
And I think this is a really useful thing for founders at any stage of, particularly actually at the early stages where you don't know what you're meant to be doing and it's all terrifying and you don't know which direction to go in. But that just leads to you not making any decisions at all. So having a strong belief, going after it until you have enough data to prove you otherwise. I suppose it's like, in some ways, it's like the lean startup kind of mantra of moving and then using data to iterate and change. Strong beliefs weekly held.
What advice would you give to entrepreneurs starting off right now, apart from join EF?
What makes you special? So think about what makes you special, and then think about how you can use that to build something that is as big as possible. I think there is sometimes a... ambition isn't celebrated in the UK. I think it's often laughed at instead of celebrated. And don't let that stop you. So think big and think why it's you that will be the person that's able to make that happen.
Okay, great advice. And finally, if you could start all over again, would you rather start a VC fund from scratch or a learning and development platform like you've done with EF?
Learning and development platform.
Okay, are you sure?
Yeah, I don't think, I mean, EF is, we have funds, but we're in many ways very different to a VC. I want to be a VC.
Would you focus on students from universities like you originally did, or other concepts like people from low-income households or just technologists? Like, do you have like a focus?
Does
like
EF exist in this world?
EF exists in this world, yeah.
Yeah, then experiment with new segments.
Okay.
So it might be interesting one around social enterprise or charity or something like that.
Okay. Raise money from investors you don't get on with at all or fail?
Raise money.
Yeah, always raise money. Mm. Good answer. Start with the same co-founder, a different co-founder, or no co-founder?
My co-founder is fantastic, so start with Matt again.
Fair enough. Will you start it in the UK, mainland Europe, or the USA, or Asia, of course, where you actually have a second base?
UK.
Yeah, why?
I think I have a lot of loyalty to the UK, and I think there's a lot of untapped resource and potential still here that creates lots of opportunities.
Right, Rich, that concludes another wonderful interview with a pretty inspiring guest. And thanks a lot to a lady that never fails to inspire me, and many others, I'm sure. But if you want to hear more from people just like Alice, then how can they do that, Rich?
So you can subscribe to us on iTunes, on Google Play Store, and on SoundCloud, and also YouTube. So go along there, subscribe to us, and you can stay up to date and make sure that you know as soon as the next episode comes out. And you can see all old episodes of podcasts on secretleaders.com. If you want to get in touch with us, email us at hello@secretleaders.com.
So if you join us next time, you'll learn a little bit from Graham Hobson, who actually is one of my investors. So I have the pleasure of spending more and more time with him than most. But, I mean, that's great for me.
Aren't all our guests your investors?
Sometimes it feels
like
that.
Just going through your cap table.
Alice said no.
Okay.
So, I mean, she's too smart for that. But he is one of the nicest people that you've ever met in the industry. And as you'll hear next week, but, you know, he recently sold Photobox for a reported £400 million, though he never confirms it and does squirm a little when it's brought up, but that is the story. So he's been on quite the journey, and it's definitely a story worth listening to. So there's no time to waste. Just go along, like Rich says, search for The Secret Lives of Leaders on any of those channels and listen away. Thank you very much.
See you next time.
Bye.